Oh!
Oh, veteran.
Called the House Committee on Human Services to order. And although I'm not our chair, I'm acting as chair today because our chair is ill, but she has assured me that she's watching us. So everybody wave. Hi, Carolyn.
Let's give her the wave.
Yeah. So we are all on our best behavior, and we have our trusty boss here. Today, we're going to be having an informational hearing on two things. We have a report on Oregon's Tobacco Prevention and Education Program, affectionately known as TPEP, with Dr. Malcone. And then we have Disability Rights Oregon, Promoting Opportunity, Access, and Choice with Bob Dunjep. So we're going to be starting with Dr. Cohn, and we're kind of limited today. We have a half hour for each presentation. So I think what we'll do is, after each presentation, take questions so they don't get mixed up. And then we have to be out of here by about 2 minutes, well, 9:28, so that people can get to their respective meetings at 9:30. So Dr. Cohn, welcome back, and you've got the mic.
Vice Chair Boone and Chair Tomei in absentia, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here this morning. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about our tobacco prevention program. I know this is an issue that we have not yet conquered fully, and I really appreciate the support that this committee has given us over the years, and I think you'll see some real progress that's been made with this program, but of course we still have some more work to do. This is a graph that shows the leading preventable causes of death in Oregon. And these are 2005 data, but if I showed you 2009 data, it would look roughly the same as this. And it's really quite astounding that tobacco still far and away outstrips all of the other preventable causes of death, including, I know I've talked with this committee and publicly quite a bit about the obesity epidemic, diet and activity issues, and although that's a large and growing problem, tobacco still, unfortunately, leads the way. It accounts for about 22% of all deaths that occur every year. That works out to about 18 Oregonians every day who die from tobacco-related illnesses. And they span a variety of different kinds of causes of death, including cardiovascular disease, cancers, and other kinds of respiratory disease. In addition, the science on secondhand smoke really in the last couple of years has become very, very clear. We estimate there are about 800 deaths due to secondhand smoke, the same disease causes of deaths, but secondhand smoke is not something that's trivial at all. And of course, all of this imposes a huge economic burden on the state as well. I'm not going to talk about the human burden that's involved. These are a lot of people with horrible illnesses. Over $2.2 billion in economic costs, and this includes medical expenses, lost productivity, and almost $300 million in cost to the Oregon Health Plan to take care of people with these illnesses. We know that if tobacco were priced to cover the actual costs, it would work out to be about $11.16 a pack. Currently, a pack of cigarettes, there's some variability from place to place, we're, you know, probably between $5 and $6 around the state. So, you know, the consumers of tobacco are not paying the costs fully that this tobacco use incurs on society. We've made quite a bit of progress. In 2007, only about 17% of adults were still smokers, and we know that about 8% of adult men use smokeless tobacco. of course, like every health event, this is not distributed equally across our population. For example, the smokeless use, particularly in rural areas of the state, is higher. And we know also that among smokers, people who earn less than $15,000 a year smoke at about three times the rate of people who earn more than $45,000 a year. This is a very addictive substance, and I think this tells us a lot about where we need to target our efforts. In addition, racial and ethnic communities across the state, the Native American community, African American community have particularly high rates of smoking, and those are groups that we have been working with to try to address the issues specifically in those groups as well. Now, this is really a pediatric problem in many ways, because most people who start to smoke do so in their youth. And we know that about 9% of eighth graders report having smoked in the past month, and that number jumps to about 16% of 11th graders. We think that those middle school years and early high school, so 7th, 8th, 9th grades, are really the key place where we need to focus to prevent kids from starting to smoke, and then hopefully preventing them from having all the complications later on in life. As I said, 90% of smokers started before the age of 18, and we estimate about 20 Oregon youth start smoking each day, and about a third of them will eventually die from a tobacco-related disease. The marketing of tobacco also targets youth in many, many ways. I know you all have seen some of the packaging I didn't bring with me today. Particularly young girls are have been in recent times an important market that the industry has gone after, packaging things in pink to things that look like cell phones and so forth to try to induce young people to start. So this is a big problem, and we've been really pretty aggressively trying to address this problem here in Oregon since 1996, when ballot measure 44 passed. This was a 30-cent a pack tax on cigarettes, and 3 cents, or 10% of that 30 cents, goes into the tobacco use reduction account, TURA, that pays for the tobacco prevention and education program. The approach that we use is a multi-component approach. There isn't any single fix for all of this. People need to hear this message in every way around them all the time. And the program has three primary goals: keeping kids from starting to smoke, I mentioned that, protecting people from secondhand smoke, and then helping people who are already smokers quit smoking. We know, again, that some people, unusual people, can quit smoking kind of cold turkey, but the success rates for doing that, we know, are in the single digits, probably 4%, 5%, 6% without any additional assistance. On the other hand, with the assistance of counseling and appropriate medication, we can double or even triple those numbers. And so providing that assistance and making sure that people are aware of it and know how to get it, make it easy for them to get it, is a very, very important part of the work that we do. Kind of to describe the philosophy that we use with this multi-component approach, I think this diagram shows three groups that we target. In the center column there, a young non-smoker, we want to prevent them from starting, a current smoker, we want to help them quit, and then a former smoker, we want to keep them former smokers. People who have been smokers and have quit report that sometimes they even have dreams about smoking. It was in many ways a very pleasurable experience, and one that's reinforced behaviorally in a variety of ways. And so it's important that the environment support people staying off of cigarettes. And you can see on the left-hand side are some of the anti-tobacco influences that we try to leverage: health education and information, the price of tobacco, advertising policies. I mentioned the issues around marketing to young people, and you know, this is an area where, unfortunately, Portland and then in the Northwest, Oregon has the dubious distinction of still being a place where this is very attractive to the industry to come and do this work. That's the advertising policies piece. Youth access to tobacco. It's illegal for minors to buy tobacco, but making sure that is in fact held up. smoke-free environments. That's part of reinforcing for people who have quit smoking, the helping support them staying quit, but also, of course, reduces the exposure of other people to secondhand smoke. Community norms, I mentioned the behavioral and pharmacological treatment that can support quitting smoking. But, you know, there is, on the right-hand side, you see a lot of pro-tobacco influences, and these are the kinds of things that we're trying to counter. Psychosocial factors, you know, at a stressful time, nicotine is a very good anti-anxiety drug. So, you know, that's a very important issue. Adult role models. If you have teenagers, I guess all of us have been, we're teenagers at one point or another, saying to a teenager, do what I'm telling you, but not what you see me doing, you know, that's the kiss of death right there. Making sure that the adult role models around kids are appropriately not smoking, not encouraging smoking. Peer pressure, of course, particularly for youth, very, very important. Product availability, I've talked about. The tobacco industry influence, tremendous amount of money spent on advertising and promotion by the industry. And addiction, this is a very, very addictive substance, and so it really requires a concerted effort to counter that force as well. So now I want to describe some of some more specific things that we've done around the state. We use evidence-based tobacco prevention programs. We fund every community in Oregon, 36 counties and 9 tribes to do this work. We have local program coordinators who work with various partners in their community to deliver interventions that are multi-component, as I mentioned, but also that are very much tailored to specific community needs and priorities and opportunities, because there is a substantial difference around the state in terms of those factors. So we support these community-based programs with funding. We provide technical assistance. We give some statewide media support as well. We do surveillance, and by that I mean tracking of tobacco use in communities around the state, and evaluation of the efforts that are ongoing. And finally, the Oregon Tobacco Quit Line, which is an 800 number that people can call. Many of our local partners do a lot of work promoting the availability of the quit line, and it's an important way that we make tobacco prevention, tobacco quitting assistance available to people very easily. So here are some examples, and I want to thank you all for your support. Our last session around Senate Bill 571, the implementation of the smoke-free workplace law, we finally closed the major loopholes there. And, you know, we also, last session, the House Bill 2135 that passed requiring landlords to disclose smoking policies in rental agreements. I think these are very, very important tools, and thank you for your support with them. What you see, the picture here, is one of the media pieces that we did to educate people about the smoke-free workplace law and the bingo halls. You see there, people loving the smell of those bingo those bingo game boards. This is an example related to the rental housing issue. You know, our smoke-free workplace law is enforced through, it's a complaint-driven enforcement. If somebody calls us to tell us that, or calls a local health department to say that there's been smoking in a place that they think it should be banned, you know, then we respond according to the authority we have under the law. One of the most common places that we get complaints about is in multi-unit housing. People complaining that smoke is drifting down the hallway into their apartment, and obviously not a workplace, so you know, it's not covered under the smoke-free workplace law. But landlords do have the ability to make their property smoke-free if they so choose. So we have the law that was passed last session that requires that this be disclosed, and what we have been doing and encouraging our community partners to do is to make sure landlords are aware of this. If they choose to make their housing units smoke-free, to support them in doing that, that, provide technical assistance for that. And this is just an article from the Oregonian that describes the trends in the Portland area, where our coalitions together with the American Lung Association have done a lot of work around this to encourage landlords to consider this option very seriously. Eastern Oregon, also, this is the Pendleton Mayor, Phil Hauck. He was very instrumental in Pendleton prohibiting free tobacco sampling at the Pendleton Roundup. That's a family event. There are kids around. I mentioned the issues with smokeless tobacco. I think this was really a major step forward for this community. Obviously, we don't have the Pendleton Roundup in Portland or in Medford, so there isn't that same opportunity. This is a great example of a very local opportunity, a very visible one for this community, and I think a terrific step forward. Here is an example from Jefferson County, the Madras Bowl going smoke-free both inside and out. This was done ahead of the Indoor Clean Air Act requiring that this happening. Again, this is some of the work of our local coalitions working with their local partners to encourage this.
Madam Chair, just if I could inject something here.
Okay.
There was Representative Huffman. I'd be a little upset that Dr. Kona is taking a look across the other side of the mountains like this so far. I'm just joking.
Mr. Vice Chair,
this will be noted
in my report to our chair.
Yes. The chair has seen this.
Go ahead, Dr. Cullen.
In Eugene, here's another example where the city council banned smoking in front of the library. Having to run the gauntlet of smokers as they go into this smoke-free facility was a problem, particularly in a place where a lot of children come and families come. So I think, again, a step forward that our tobacco coalition, together with the elected leadership, really did a terrific job on. And this is another issue, the candy-like tobacco products that are test marketed here in Oregon. This was an example from Jackson County, where local communities have really spoken out to warn parents about these nicotine-containing items that really they're candy-like. They're really marketed towards kids and, I suppose, towards the kid in all of us. And they, again, encourage people to take the next step and move down the road towards using tobacco. Here, also, we're very proud of the work that's been done in the community college system. Mount Hood Community College and Portland Community College have gone smoke-free. There are some others, actually, with me here, just mention them here. Tillamook Bay Community College and Oregon Coast Community Colleges are also tobacco-free, and we understand that Clackamas and Rogue Community Colleges are about to go there, and Clatsop as well. So, again, terrific step forward, particularly aimed at young people, very, very important. So this is my last slide, and I think the point I want to drive home to you, and you all have a copy of our program report. Some of the specific stories of some of the successes we've had are in the report, so feel free to look at that. I think the point here is that when TPEP started back in 1997, you can see the arrow there on the graph, we were kind of running neck and neck with the national rates of per capita tobacco use, per capita cigarette consumption. And once we started with this multi-component intervention, while the rate of tobacco use was declining nationally, we were able to drive it down at about twice the rate of decrease that was being seen nationally. But this is very, very directly related to how much funding we have. Certainly the state has a lot of budget pressures that you all have to deal with. I know those are difficult choices to make. But given the incredible toll that this takes on our state, on our communities, I think it's really important that we continue the support of this program and increase it as we're able to do it. You can see that in 2003, in that session when the funding was cut, really had a very devastating effect. And the pro-tobacco forces that I showed you in that one diagram, those continued even if the anti-tobacco forces that we were marshaling, we weren't able to continue to the same extent. And you can see really the curve starts to change there. The red line starts to curve back up. And then when our funding was restored back to its original levels in 2007, we started the decline again. So there's a very direct association between how effective we're going to be at dealing with this and how well this activity is funded. I hope that, I'm not aware that there are going to be any major issues around tobacco prevention funding in the waning hours of this session, but certainly I expect that next session these issues will be up before you again. There will be some policy initiatives as well that we will be bringing to you, and I appreciate your support in the past, and I hope you will continue to support us in the future.
Thank you.
I'll be happy to answer questions.
Okay. I'm going to have Van Orman and then Doherty. Okay.
Thank you, Vice Chair Boone. One of the questions I have, in, when we talk about funding, coming from Hood River County, we have a very active group in Hood River County. So my question revolves around when you experience these cuts, how deeply does it affect the counties?
Vice Chair Boone, Representative Van Orman. So when we get a cut, the way that we manage these cuts is we have an advisory group that includes representation from the counties, but also from a variety of other partners, the Lung Association, Cancer Society, and so forth. So we try to distribute those cuts across the components of the program in a way that will minimize the damage that will be done. In the past, we have tried very hard to spare the counties, and the reason for this is that it's an issue of hiring staff and getting that kind of expertise and experience on board. That's not something you can easily just turn on and off in a minute. By comparison, for example, our media efforts, we can relatively easily increase or decrease the amount of media time that we buy, for example, and that's more flexible. So that's certainly one factor that I think we try to take into account. On the other hand, depending on the level of funding that you have, which components of the program you really need to preserve the most, if you're funded at a very low level, for example, we also have to take that into consideration. And in that kind of a setting, we had to... When we're funded at a very low level, focusing on things like statewide media, for example, are thought to be, the some of the most important things that we need to preserve. This doesn't just reflect my opinion or our staff's opinion. This is a national opinion, comes from the Centers for Disease Control. It's well documented and based on research. I will say that, this last round, based on the budget that we got last session, the forecast of tobacco revenue was down quite a bit, and so the budget that we got had a pretty substantial cut, and we did have to dip into the county support as part of that. But as those tobacco revenues have come in at a higher level, we will be one of the places we will be trying to restore those dollars to is the county programs, because I think they are incredibly important in terms of accomplishing this work.
Thank you.
Representative Doherty.
Okay, as a former longtime smoker, I appreciate the programs that you have, and more importantly, as somebody whose husband died at 45 of lung cancer as a longtime smoker, I appreciate these programs. But one component that isn't in here, and I know it's a little more difficult to work with, is I quit smoking because of help of my employer. And there was an incentive program from the employer, and part of it was, workplace health and this kind of thing, because they went smokeless decades ago. So maybe that might be a component later on in planning that you'd want to look at some sort of incentives for employers to help, because it is very, very, anyone that smoked for a long time, very, very difficult. In fact, the program I went through, it's more addictive than heroin and sometimes harder to get off of. So anything that employers can do also in the planning stages would be very good.
Representative Boone, Representative Doherty, that is a great point. The workplace is going smoke-free, I think, is a major step in that direction. But you're right, there's more that employers can do to incentivize this and remind employees that these benefits are available, for example. We have been working in a broad sense on workplace wellness. We have a wellness initiative that we have been working on that I think you will be hearing more about, and I expect by next session you will hear even more about it, that not only within state government but also with private sector partners to encourage a variety of wellness activities. You know, the healthcare system is under so much cost pressure. We can't solve that just by putting more money into treating people. We've got to get at some of the forces that are driving the need for health care, and I think this is a very, very important one. So thank you for raising that. It's a great, great, very important piece of this.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Last week, we had Dr. Beglin testify to us, and I don't know if I don't believe you were in the audience because you're busy doing your public health thing, and congratulations, by the way, in becoming the director. You are now the full-time. I mean, you're not the interim. You were interim for a long time.
Vice Chair Bowen, Representative Maurer, I'm actually still in acting status. But
well, dang it. Bruce, get on that.
You're a good actor.
Pull the trigger, Bruce.
Thank you.
He had a slide and referred to a study that was done, and actually it was in 2004, and it had costs for various problems. And the thing that was most startling in that report was that the cost for smoking-related illness, $5.1 million. And everything else was $1 billion or hundreds of millions of dollars. And I'm trying to get that study, and I thought it was really interesting. And I did find out that was for 1 year cost. And so your $2.2 billion economic cost can't be for 1 year, that has to be over a lifetime. Or can you explain it? Because the difference, you know, it'd be really nice to have information, because when you get one presentation and you have 5.1 million and you have one that has 2,200 million, you know, 2.2 billion, you go, well, let's talk apples to apples here, because I do think there's a huge economic impact. But you know, not everything can cost us billions of dollars. I mean, at some point, the pie's only so big, and so let's figure out really what's going on. Can you comment?
Vice Chair Boone, Representative Maurer, I'm not familiar with the specific study that Dr. Beglin was referencing. He is a long-time collaborator, supporter of our tobacco prevention program, and I'm sure it's a very reputable and high-quality study if he was quoting it to you. I would suspect that the difference in numbers depends on what's included in economic costs. For example, not only the time periods involved, but are you talking about lost productivity and how that is calculated? Are you talking about just the actual medical costs incurred? You know, there are a variety of ways to estimate this. So I will be happy to talk with Dr. Beglin, find out what he was referring to, and clarify that for you.
And follow up. He actually, I talked to him afterwards, and he said, well, that was one point that he pushed back on this report because the number seemed off. But I just thought it was really strange. Mm-hmm. That there was such a huge difference. And the other thing that really absolutely frustrates me is the tobacco settlement money that we have diverted. We bonded it essentially to pay for lights back in 2003, which I think was a huge mistake. In fact, that money was specifically designed, I'm preaching to the choir here, but was there to do exactly what TPEP is doing. And I think we've really misallocated those funds, but there's still a little portion that could come back to fund TPEP. Last session, it was $20 million that was unallocated, and I hope you advocate for that, because that's where that money needs to go.
Representative Boone, Representative Maurer, you're absolutely correct. We don't get any master settlement agreement dollars. This was the settlement that was negotiated by the attorneys general with the tobacco companies, and the dollars were based on the medical costs. It was initially to recoup some of those medical costs and to fund prevention efforts. And at this point, we don't get any of those for tobacco prevention. We would be very supportive of moving in that direction. So we'll be coming to talk with you about how we might make that happen. Thank you.
Thank you. Rep. Embro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of questions. First, a quick one. Now, another thing that we did last session was we voted to ban vending machines from places where children could go. Has that gone into effect yet? Is that working?
Representative Boone, Representative Dembro, I believe it has gone into effect. And I don't believe we've had any problems with the implementation of it. I think that was a very important bill to pass, in large part because of the symbolic nature of it. I think it really, the number of people affected was relatively small, but I think very, very important to change that social norm around the availability of tobacco products for young people. And when the tobacco is available in a vending machine like that, it makes it possible for kids when nobody's looking. Nobody has to card them for them to take it out of the machine. So I think it was an important step forward. Thank you for mentioning that.
Okay. Thanks. And just a follow-up to that.
Real quick, because we're cutting into the next presenter's time, and I have one more person. But go ahead. Sorry.
Okay. The other thing that we did with vending machine, we made a policy decision not to ban them from places where only adults would go, bars, taverns, et cetera, which I think was a good choice. But is that something that's going to be monitored at all? There was a concern that underage people are still getting into those areas to buy the cigarettes. Is that something anybody is tracking in any way? Or is that complaint-driven? Or how will that work?
Representative Boone, Representative Dembro, we do ask kids in our Oregon Healthy Teens survey how often they smoke and where they get tobacco products. So we do have some information on that. I guess there are two ways that kids could get it from tobacco that originated in a vending machine in a bar, for example. So either they sneak in and get it, or an adult buys it and then gives it to them. I think if they got it themselves from a vending machine, our way of tracking it would pick that up. I'm not sure we have a good way to track the other, although I do think we ask about having gotten tobacco from adults. And I should mention, this is a little bit of a footnote, but we are having some very serious problems with funding our Oregon Healthy Teen Survey. This is a major way that we track not only tobacco use, but a variety of youth risk behaviors. And that's something you will be hearing more about in the interim next session, because this is a fundamental piece of public health infrastructure that you all depend on when you ask us about things like this or other youth risk behaviors, and it's become a very big problem for us. So,
and Rep. Olson.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Dr. Cohn, at the very beginning of your presentation, you shared a couple percentages of what's happening within the schools within the last 30 days. I have always been curious to ask the question, what's your methodology to determine that? Because I can see a whole lot of different angles of doing that, but I've always been curious.
Representative Boone, Representative Olson, that's a self-report measure. We ask kids that question. It's part of this Oregon Healthy Teens survey that we do. So, it is self-report. Of course, that means that some people don't tell the truth. On the other hand, the way we look at it is the number of kids who don't tell the truth is roughly the same from year to year. And so we can still track the trends in this. And 9%, even if a lot of kids aren't admitting to smoking, is still a pretty substantial number. Probably an underestimate, though.
Yeah, thank you. I'll
pass. And are you sure?
Yeah.
Okay.
I answered my own question.
Thank you, Dr. Conan. I will reserve my questions for another time, because I know you'll be back before us at some point in the interim for some reason. But thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very interesting. And our next presenter is Bob Dundeff, Disability Rights Oregon. And Bob, do you need the power? Okay. So we don't have to shift there. And thanks for the lights, Patty.
The family photos. Sorry.
Just there.
And we'll do the same. We'll let Mr. Junda do his presentation and then have questions after, if that's agreeable to everybody.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Jundeff. I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon, and I want to thank you for this opportunity. I've had many opportunities to speak to groups just before lunch, and it's never compared to this, where I know that I'm sitting between you and the end of a legislative session. So I'll try to move it. And I believe that you are being handed out some materials that we provided, and there's an awful lot of information in there. And again, there's so much I could talk about here, so I thought about how could I sum up and get across to everyone what exactly Disability Rights Oregon does. And so I thought that I might do that by bringing up three little phrases that encapsulate what I would say disability rights is all about, because we are an organization that exists in order to further the concept and the application of disability rights. The first phrase I would bring to you is the phrase, nothing about us without us. And that's a flagship motto in the disability rights movement, because the idea is that just as in any other area of life, when either in the public or the private sector, that services, devices are being designed for people, that you want to get them involved because you want to understand what it is that people want, how you can fulfill their needs in a manner that will satisfy them and will work effectively. There's so many places in our government structures and in our private structures in which there's discussions about what people with disabilities need, but folks never get around to talking to those individuals themselves. Part of the reason that we were put into or created, and I'll get into that in a minute, is to be a voice for those folks. Now, I am not an individual with disabilities, although within the structure of our organization, as I will talk about, we are designed to really drill down and understand what it is that the communities of people with disabilities want, what's important to them, and what message that I can bring forward to you and to others about that. The next phrase is something that when I first started this work about 30 years ago, I came into contact with, and it's a phrase out of social work, and it's called, the phrase is want, get, keep. So what does that mean? Think about our old model of providing services to disabled populations, where we had large institutions or set services that were available and funded by the public, and if a person wanted to take advantage of those services, they were admitted or enrolled, and they got whatever it is that was provided. Sometimes it fit and sometimes it didn't fit. Most of the time that person had to adjust themselves to whatever it is that we decided that they might want. That model has changed over time. And I liken it to something that's also, it happened in all areas of life. And in fact, most of the things in the disability world are reflective of things that have happened in all areas of life. If you go to an employment counselor now to talk about your future, it will not be assumed that making a bunch of money is going to make you happy. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. But the first thing that the employment counselor is going to talk to you about is, what do you want in life? What's important to you? How can you fulfill those needs? Is important to you have a job that's flexible, where you can spend more time with your family? Is that not important to you? Or there's communities of interest that you have? Could it be your faith community? Could it be your social community? These are things that you talk about. And so the idea here is that rather than providing just a one model fits all, that services are designed around the individual. You talk to that individual, find out what it is they need, and that's the want. What do you want? If we are able to figure out what you want, then we can help you get it, and you're going to be invested in trying to get it. That's one of the things that we do at the Advocacy Center, is that people call us because they want something. They're having trouble getting it. part of what we do is help them try to get it. And if we succeed, and if that person succeeds in getting what it is that they want, that's something that they're going to want to keep. And so they're going to work hard to try to keep that rather than passively accept whatever it is that's offered to them. We changed our name recently, and we have a whole new logo, and that was an exciting process going, figuring out how to do that. Part of what we did was we tried to come up with three words that encapsulated what we do. And so that's made my job a little bit easier. First, that instead of being called Oregon Advocacy Center, where you say, well, what are you advocating for? Disability Rights Oregon pretty clearly states what we're about. But our three words that we came up with are opportunity, access, and choice. And again, these bring us back to the idea that people with disabilities, what they're after is to be able to function in the world like other people to the extent that they can and to the extent that they need services and supports, that those services and supports should be designed to help them accomplish that. So our first word, opportunity, means just that, that people are able to enter into society and have the same types of opportunities that everybody else has. Right at the beginning of life, early intervention services through education and special education services are specifically designed to help people even the playing field, if you will, when dealing with a disability and help their parents to provide them what they need in order to do that. That's why special education has advocacy has been one of the primary roles that we have played ever since our founding in 1977. And that's why one of the documents I'm handing you today is about one of our most recent initiatives. It has to do with the use of seclusion and restraint of kids with disabilities in schools and our attempt to try to bring down that use and to increase the use of effective behavioral analysis and interventions so that a kid can succeed in school. In the years that I've worked in this area, I think special education has been absolutely the key to people not only succeeding as individuals, but also allowing us to do things like close institutions and to expand our community services, because when kids get early intervention, when kids get good special education services, they have an incredibly greater opportunity to succeed in society and not be dependent upon social services and to be able to live with their families instead of in some institution. And so this has always been an area that we have concentrated on. And parents and kids need help in these systems because they're complicated. They have to face large bureaucracies and not to badmouth these educators, but educators who are strapped with limited resources that have to make tough decisions. And the message of a parent who is not a good self-advocate, who may have problems with language, may have problems with understanding how these systems work, having a good advocate with them who can explain how they work, can make sure that their points get raised, and who know what might be available to them is incredibly important to them and can spell the difference between success or failure of that child, not only in school, but in their adult lives. Access, the word access, which is our second word, has to do with just being able to get in the door. In its simplest form, it means that, yes, there is a ramp to get into a building instead of stairs. To say that a person is being treated equally because there are the stairs and anybody can use them is not true, because everybody can't use the stairs. And so we know that there are costs to allowing access, particularly with people with physical disabilities, but we have a society had made a decision that we want to have a world in which we can all participate everywhere. James Taves and many others have come before you and talked about the tsunami of seniors that we're going to be facing in the years ahead, and I can guarantee you, as a boomer myself, that our physical abilities will be deteriorating as time goes on, and that if we want to remain active in society, if we want to be able to be employed, if we want to be able to come down to the Capitol and advocate for our interests and speak our voice, that we're going to need to be able to get in the door. And some of us are going to be in scooters, and some of us are going to have walkers, and we're not going to be able to get up the front steps of the Capitol. And every time that, I can tell you that every time that people who I work with are told that, well, you can come into the Capitol, but you have to use the side door, or you have to use the back door, they don't feel like they're being treated equally in society. And again, there are costs to leveling the playing field in some of these areas, but these are costs that we are going to need to make as we move ahead if we want to have an inclusive society, and that's part of the access. And that also goes for people with cognitive disabilities and mental disabilities as well as physical. The last word is choice, and I talked about that earlier, is that just like if you go into the grocery store today, there's no longer just a few cereal brands. You'll have an entire aisle dedicated to everybody's choice. Part of what people want in all walks of life is choice. Probably in the service sector in Oregon that we have had the greatest hand in helping to create the Staley service system for people with developmental disabilities, that is a system that is based on choice. And the idea being, again, that rather than a publicly funded or even privately funded entity saying, here's what we offer, you can have it or leave it, in Staley, an individual has access to a certain pot of resources. They sit down with a counselor and work out what it is, what are the services, what are the supports, what are the, and sometimes physical objects that might help them stay in the home, might help them get out to recreation, get out to socialization, in other words, have a life in a way that's most efficient. And so the Staley service system has proven to be something that is wildly popular because it's designed to help people determine what they want, get what they want, and then they want to keep that because that keeps them with their families, keeps them in society, and keeps them out of costly publicly funded services. So that's part of that is a phrase that we've had on some of our materials recently has been the idea of the disability right that we really promote is the right to live in the world, to be like other folks. So when did this all begin? 1977. In 1977, I always like to come back to this. Geraldo Rivera, as a young journalist, snuck into a institution in Staten Island, New York, that housed people with developmental disabilities, and just took a bunch of film, and it became all the rage because the conditions there were absolutely horrendous, and the feeling was something had to be done about that. And then Senator Jacob Javits from New York came to Congress, and they came up with an idea, which was to come up with some resources to encourage states to make progress in this area. And the idea resulted in what's now called the Developmental Disabilities Network. It had four different parts, and one part was to providing states money to create something called Developmental Disabilities Councils. We have one here in Oregon. You know Catherine White. She works with the DD Council. It's part of state government, and they get funding from the Administration on Developmental Disabilities to work with families and to promote training and understanding both here and in other parts of the state about developmental disabilities issues. They came up with some money to give to universities to work on best practices. We have two centers of excellence here in Oregon, Health Sciences and at U of O, that both get money through the DD Act to do that type of research. And then the other idea was protection and advocacy, which is what we are. And the thinking there was that, we have a whole bunch of policies and incentives here, but we don't have any way for the people themselves to get help in understanding what these laws are and applying them. And so these folks are going to need some lawyers and who understand these rules, understand these laws, and when a person is experiencing difficulties, when their civil rights are being violated in an institution because they're being harmed, they're victims of abuse or neglect, or their other civil rights are being violated, or their access to services are being blocked because of various problems, they're going to need a legal advocate to help them. And thus, protection and advocacy was born, and there was money given to each state to open offices. In Oregon, a nonprofit was created for the express purpose of doing that. It was designated to perform this role by Governor Straub at the time, and then that's when we came into being. The over the years, and how am I doing on time?
Doing okay, and we'll. I'm not sure how much time you have left. We have to leave at 9:30, so.
Right. So I'm going to zoom forward. Just to say that in the years since then, a number of things have happened. One is that there's been a variety of the model that we have, which is local nonprofit with local board of Oregonians, over half of whom have to have a disability or be family members of disability, so that we're close to our communities, not some federal bureaucracy. That this organization and one that sets priorities every year by getting talking to our community about what we want to do is a good model, and it's a cost-effective model. And so a number of other federal laws have channeled money into this model over the years, so that now we represent the full range of people with disabilities in a whole variety of areas, and they're listed in your information. But all under that same general philosophy, we provide information referral services. So we have three intake specialists who just do that every day. We get over 3,000 calls a year, generally. Some of those become what we call intakes, where they get full analysis by our 11 lawyers. Some become cases, where we're helping people get services, or we're responding to abuse or neglect allegations. Under state law, and federal law, we have authority to go into any facility in the state to investigate abuse or neglect of individuals with disabilities, and we have the right to have records of people who are unable because of their mental condition to give consent and don't have a guardian to do so, so that people cannot be isolated without outside eyes coming in. And we do systemic advocacy, which is what you see me do when I come here, is talking to advocacy groups and people to be able to promote interests both in the legislature, in state and local agencies, and we do litigation. And again, the Staley case is an example of that. We have gone to court over conditions in the state hospital, the other one that you may have heard of fairly recently is we've gone to bat recently for group homes that are trying to move into communities and are meeting community resistance. I might add that that is something that, as you all know, is very politically touchy. But those individuals who want to live in those institutions have rights under federal and state law. And it falls to an organization like ours to represent those interests, and we do. that's the quick overview.
I think
I've left 5 minutes.
You're such a great resource, and I appreciate the information you sent. Although I didn't print it out, I read it online last night, and it's all up here. But I'm going to keep it. I will print it out and put it in my file. So I have Rep. Maurer has a question.
Yeah, it's really not a question. Bob, I just want, as I'm going out of this process, thank you for all of your support. You've been very helpful to us in helping constituents at the local level in providing information, advocacy. And so it's been a pleasure to work with you. And this is for the rest of the committee, too, that there is a thing called the Mental Health and Addictions Caucus. Bob is a co-chair of that. I'm a co-chair. and it was started by AVEL Senator Gordley, and it, she passed the baton to me, and the baton will have to be passed. And so I'm going to be asking someone to step up to the plate and take that over. It's not a partisan issue, and it's really a caucus in loose terms, in that it's an opportunity for people in the mental health and addictions field, in a larger sense, to get together and talk about issues that are relevant to them during the session. And so you get a lot of advocates, you get consumers, and I want someone that is interested in this to carry the baton and really make it their own. But I, Bob, I hope you help me find someone that, that can fit that bill, because every legislature, the tenor changes, and you know, there are going to be new challenges next time. And so I think it does serve a function, its value, and just appreciate your efforts.
I'm sure it was in enough. Thank you very much, and thank you for carrying that banner. I know it's very important to this community, mm-hmm. and it's something that we have to continually go back to in terms of its importance.
Rick Wilson?
Madam Chair, I just want to mention, Bob, I greatly appreciate your help, too, over the last few years with a number of different issues, but I appreciate you sharing with us your three phrases this morning. That was good. And the accessibility that you've caused for me, you know, to you. So thank you for that.
Thanks.
Anybody else have a comment, question?
Anyone else can ask a question?
Oh, sure.
Thank you. Yeah. Just out of curiosity, Bob, with the Oregon State Hospital and U.S. Department of Justice, Civil Rights Division, how does DRO fit in with that oversight or issue going on?
Well, the U.S. Department of Justice, of course, we don't have any affiliation with the U.S. Right. Department of Justice, Mr. Committee Administrator. The Department of Justice is under law can enforce the Civil Rights of Institutionalized Persons Act. They are the only entity that can do so. They're, of course, they're an enormous organization that moves very slowly, and it's, sometimes when they land in your state, it can be troubling. The last time they landed before Oregon State Hospital was with Fairview Training Center. And for those of you who don't remember, Fairview Training Center's closure was not actually the result of the lawsuit brought by the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice settlement called for enormous new resources to be put into that institution. And the state realized that after doing so that they were not getting the bang for the buck, which resulted in ultimately in the closure of Fairview. I'd like to add that it's been 10 years now mm-hmm. since the closure of Fairview, and there's a celebration today outside. We'll have some materials out there to so that you can see the effects of the closure of a large state institution. I'd also add, in just time-wise, that it's also been it's the 10th anniversary this year of something called the Olmstead decision, which was the Supreme Court of the United States deciding that the Americans with Disabilities Act prohibits the unnecessary segregation of people with disabilities. And we are still challenged by that decision today in Oregon because we still in many, even though we have very progressive policies in some areas in terms of deinstitutionalization, that we have a ways to go. The one thing I wanted to mention, as long as I have a minute, is that our organization, although we have grown in terms of responsibilities over the year, we have not grown in terms of funding. And the last 5 years, you know, with the federal budget problems and so forth, is that we have experienced flat funding. With the recession, our areas of private support have decreased. And so the demand has not. And so this has just been our reality. And so we have actually been shaving services for the last few years. And so we're hoping to bring that to people's attention as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks.
With that, I'll close the informational hearing. And committee, this is the last meeting until our, well, the next interim meeting, which Representative Tomei will chair, I'm sure. And I think they're in April, but
May.
Okay. Close the committee on House Committee on Human Services.